This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at southdakotachannel.org.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the governor's first legislative press conference. My name is Kelsey Pritchard. I'm the communications director in the governor's office. With the governor this morning is the commissioner of the Bureau of Finance and Management, Jason Dilges, and we also have Keith Singer from BFM as well. Just a reminder for everyone on the phone, you can mute your lines now by pressing star 6, and during Q&A, you can unmute by pressing pound 6. And everyone in the room, another reminder to use the mics at the table. And with that, I'll turn it over to Governor Dennis Dugard.
Thank you, Kelsey, and thank you, everyone in the room and on the line for being with us for this press conference. I'd like to open up by announcing today we are releasing the 2015 Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for South Dakota. This is a document that is released every year that looks back at our fiscal year ended last June 30th. And I brought along Keith Singer, who is the Director of Accounting Analysis and Financial Reporting, because he is Jason Dilges' key leader for the effort to produce this document. And I would like to make note of the fact that this document is being issued on January 22nd, ahead of their self-imposed deadline, which would be next week. And it is 5 months earlier than we were issuing a similar document when I came into office. One of the things that, of course, concerned all of us at the time I was first elected and we began calendar year 2011 was the financial condition of our nation and the financial condition of our state in the wake of the Great Recession. And one of the reflections on any entity that reports financial data is the length of time it takes that entity to close their books and report the outcome of the financial year just ended. And when I came into office, our CAFR, our Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, was being issued nearly a full year after we ended our fiscal year. To be more specific, our CAFR for 2011 was issued on June 20th of 2012. So nearly a full year later. And even though I think we've always managed our finances very responsibly, and in some ways the recession and the government stimulus money, which introduced a lot of complexity into our financial accounting, some of that is responsible for the delay in getting our CAFR out. Still, it does reflect, it gives the reader less confidence in the reporting entity, whether it be a private business or a government, if it takes them nearly a year to close the books and report out the revenue and expenses, assets and liabilities of the entity. So Jason and I got together and we talked with with Marty Ginden, our legislative auditor general, and we talked about how can we do better, how can we produce our financial report more quickly. And over the years, we've been establishing interim dates, and so the 2012 of CAFR was released near the end of March in 2013. The 2013 CAFR was mid-March of 2014. The 2014 CAFR was issued at the end of February in 2015, and here we are in January of 2016 issuing the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for 2015, and our goal next year is to get it out before the calendar year end. So we'll get out our 2016 CAFR on or before December 31st of 2016. So I'm here to celebrate their achievement, and it's a pretty thick document. It's very significant, and it also reflects well upon our state, not just in the timeliness of the document, but in the financial data contained within. Last week, we also issued our long-term budget, our five-year budget, looking back a year in actual numbers, looking at our current year, looking at the future year, the budget year FY17, and years ahead of that. We also issued an updated capital expenditure plan last week. We also issued a report self-examining our debt load and comparing it to self-imposed restrictions that are now in statute as a consequence of our recommendation to the legislature and their agreement to make debt limitation benchmarks part of our state statute. So those things are available on the BFM website or in OpenSD. There are links there. And then earlier this month, again in the area of financial reporting, the Lieutenant Governor and Commissioner Dilges made another trip to New York to meet with our credit rating agencies. S&P, as you know, we successfully convinced them that we deserve AAA credit rating last year, and we had very good meetings with them. We also they also met with Moody's and with Fitch, and we had good conversations with them, and we're hopeful that Fitch will reevaluate our credit status sometime in late spring or early summer. And they just reviewed and revised their algorithms for evaluating states and their creditworthiness, and we're hopeful their new methodology will reflect well on South Dakota, and they might consider us worthy of their AAA rating as well. So those are all pieces of good financial news. I'll mention we have, if not already issued, we'll momentarily issue a press release about this CAFR being released ahead of schedule. One bullet point I'm going to mark on the press release, it's the last bullet point, and that is the state reported a net pension asset of $159 million at the end of the fiscal year. That's the surplus, I would say, over our liabilities for state employees. It doesn't include school employees or municipal employees in the state retirement system plan. And it is an asset, which is very unusual. In fact, so unusual, when we sent data on this to some of our credit reporting agencies, Moody's, S&P, they called and said, oh, we think you made a mistake because you're not showing a pension liability because it is so rare. There may be one or two others in the nation that have an asset here where everyone else has a liability, a debt they owe, and some, Kentucky, others, Illinois, have very significant liabilities that they're reporting, where we're one of the very few that are actually reporting an asset. Again, I think an indication that South Dakota is managing its finances as a state very responsibly. And I'm very proud of Jason and Keith and their whole team for the good work they do on our behalf. So that is the information I just wanted to initiate our conversation with. And now I'm happy to take any questions on that topic or on any topic whatsoever.
Governor, have you seen the measure introduced that would require drug testing for food stamps or cash benefits?
I have not seen that. I've heard about it. We've seen those kinds of measures introduced in the past, and we've not been especially enthused about them. While it sounds good and makes a good headline, and certainly we don't want to support illegal drug use in any part of our society, I think the suggestion that those who are receiving welfare benefits should somehow be tested while others who receive government benefits are not tested is somewhat discriminatory, not discriminatory, insulting to those people. I think it's also true that some other states who have initiated this kind of testing have spent quite a bit of money on it and really discovered or uncovered very little as a consequence and wasted that money. And so I don't like to waste money in South Dakota.
So would you say you oppose?
I haven't seen the measure, but I haven't been enthused about those kinds of measures in the past. I do not support any kind of drug use, and I'm opposed to that, certainly. But I don't know that the money we would spend, while it might make us feel good, it would be wasted money, I believe.
Lawmakers today also introduced a 20-week abortion ban. How would that fare if it crossed your desk?
Well, I oppose abortion at any term of pregnancy. I think we need to evaluate how that bill would impact other legislation that the legislature has passed in South Dakota that is currently pending, and if that would help or hurt our position in court. But I have not seen that.
Governor, earlier today, Republicans told us that they want to see very strict accountability standards for your teacher pay proposal. They want to make sure all those dollars make it to teachers. How do you toe the line of ensuring that accountability, but also allowing for local control?
Well, I think the proposal, as I envisioned it, and again, we have not drawn the accountability and reporting aspects of the legislation with specificity yet, because we want legislative input on that. Conceptually, though, I would say there was not an intent to mandate teacher pay be at a certain level or mandate every dollar that this program produces be spent in the teacher pay arena. There may be some school districts that are already well above the state average, and maybe those dollars don't need to be addressed toward teacher pay in those particular districts. We've always given a nod and deference to local control. Now, all that being said, I do think the accountability measures should provide great transparency to the taxpayers in those districts and to the parents and to the teachers so that they can fully understand and have good conversations with their school leadership, both school board members and administrators, for the spending and staffing decisions they're making. And so that if at the local level they are maintaining a teaching staff that is larger perhaps than would be efficient, and they're spending those dollars by spreading them over more persons and not achieving the levels that they could otherwise achieve if they were more efficient, that should be transparent to the taxpayers. And maybe that's what they want and support. And if so, then I believe the local taxpayers should have that decision, and I don't think that the state government should take that from them. But it's important that the accountability measures make it very clear and apparent to local taxpayers and parents and teachers how those decisions are being made. And so those ratios that are the targets through the efficiency that are driven by the formula, the degree to which a school district is meeting or failing to meet them in the year in question or over time, I think is something that needs to be easily seen by the taxpayer. Give one example.
Governor, this is Kara Hart with the Red River Farm Network out of Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I was wanting to know about the legislative session currently underway and the priorities for agriculture and anything we needed to keep on our radar for our growers.
Priorities for agriculture, good question. I know the Department of Agriculture has some legislation that it will be offering. Some of it will be to reduce regulation and omit needless rules and laws. Anytime we can relieve our ag producers from regulatory burden, I think that's good. We also have, in my recommended budget, further investment into railroads in South Dakota. And I know also in North Dakota, you rely heavily on rail to move your grain products to out-of-state markets. Unlike some other states to the east of us, we don't have access to barge traffic, and states south of Sioux City, Iowa have access to barge traffic. We don't enjoy that because of the Missouri River dams. So again, we rely heavily on rail, and South Dakota's investment in rail has prompted quite a bit of investment in the past. The improvement of the rail between Chamberlain and Mitchell prompted the Liberty Grain Terminal to be built, and that improved prices for producers in that area. The construction that is now underway between Chamberlain and Presho has prompted the wheat growers to build a new grain terminal at Kennebec, and that's well underway, and both that rail and that grain terminal should be operational by this fall. Our improvement of the Britton Line in northeast South Dakota that comes into southeastern North Dakota is going to create, for the first time, head-to-head competition by two between two Class One railroads, and has, as a consequence, encouraged a $30 million grain terminal to be built and is under construction now in Britton. So those are areas that improve infrastructure in ways that have direct consequence to ag producers. We also were pleased to announce just this within the last month the decision of AGP to build the largest their largest capital investment in soybean processing in Aberdeen, South Dakota. I know that's going to benefit soybean producers in southern North Dakota and in northeastern South Dakota. This will be their largest capital investment in their history, and they are the largest soybean processing co-op in the world. So it's going to be a very big plant, and Aberdeen is celebrating, and so are the soybean producers around Aberdeen. We're also glad that Northern Beef Packers, the old Northern Beef Packers, New Angus, has started to slaughter cattle again in Aberdeen, and they're going slowly because they're still learning this new plant and how to make sure they can meet their wastewater standards, but that will help beef prices in that area and encourage feeding cattle in that area. So those are just some of the areas where we've been trying to be active in ways that benefit ag producers. Thank you for the question.
What about the water redistricting? How is that coming along?
I know the summer study last year created a law that I signed into, or create a bill that I signed into law to look at forming and managing drainage in water drainage watersheds rather than in political boundaried counties. And it makes sense to manage drainage within a watershed rather than within discrete counties, many of which may fall within watersheds or straddle watersheds. Water projects cost money, though. And so in the beginning, the pilots, I think, that are intended, right now we've got a pilot, I believe it's in the northeast South Dakota area, and so we're going to have to see how that pilot works and whether it's effective in helping make good drainage decisions and improve things for ag producers in that area, and also protect the environment as well.
Governor, earlier today, the State Affairs Committee passed a proposal that would limit the autonomy of the State Board on geographic names. Were you concerned at all about their taking up of a recommendation to change the name of Horny Peak, and is that something that you would want to put back in the legislature's hands?
Well, philosophically, I am generally supportive of limiting government to the bureaucracy necessary and no more to fulfill our functions. And as I understand it, and I'm not an expert on the history of the Board of Geographic Names, but as I recall, the board was created to deal with offensive names, names which anyone in South Dakota, regardless of their understanding of history, would immediately see as offensive. The word itself was offensive. So that board, I think, looked at creeks and valleys and geographic features that had names that would generally be found offensive to many people today. And I think they identified through a good process what local input would be for an alternative name, and discussed them and identified alternative names and chose them. and they really fulfilled, I think, the function that they were intended to fulfill, and then they continued to exist. And then the Harney Peak issue came up, and that's a renaming of a feature that I would say to most South Dakotans is not offensive because they're completely unaware of the history of the name of the person for whom that peak was named. And so I think it's no surprise that the legislature is concerned that that commission is finding new missions when their initial mission had been completed. And in general, I would say if we have a board or commission whose function is minimal and whose original function has been largely completed, I would not be offended by the abolition of that board or commission, including this one.
Dana, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. Governor, earlier this week, your office released the results of a poll that you commissioned in December regarding using a sales tax for teacher pay. Just wondering if you could speak to why you commissioned that poll and why you decided to release it to legislators on Wednesday.
Sure. Well, I poll every so often. Certainly, I polled quite frequently during my campaigns. I would also poll sometimes midterm to see what voter attitudes were on various issues. That helped inform me about what people thought and also what might be doable in terms of the legislature and their willingness to support a proposal or not. A governor has only so much political capital, and it's something that if you put it in the drawer and never use it, when you open up the drawer, over time it dissipates. It's like a bottle with the cap left off. It evaporates over time. At the same time, when you have it, you only have a limited amount of it. And so you have to judge when you can use it and where you should use it, because once that's used up through fruitless efforts, then you don't have anything to use on fruitful, potentially fruitful efforts. So I polled not to judge for myself what I thought would be the right course, but what I thought, to find out what the public would support and potentially then the legislators that they elected would support. And I was informed then through that poll that a half-cent increase in the sales tax had strong support among Republicans, Independents, and Democrats. On average, over 70%, 71% of voters, very likely voters, not just South Dakotans, but voters, would support a half-cent increase in the sales tax for teacher pay. And so I wanted the legislature to understand that because, of course, legislators are subject to re-election. I'm not going to run for re-election, so I'm not doing what I think will get me re-elected again. I'm not running again. I'm doing what I think is right, what I think is doable and possible and will solve a problem in South Dakota. And the poll I released to the legislature so they could see that they could vote for such a thing without offending their electorate and that they, in fact, would be representing their electorate's attitude with a yes vote.
Are there any questions on the phone line? Any other questions in the room?
The Republican leadership, I got the sense that they're unsure about the half-cent sales tax unless they can have assurances that the money will go to teacher pay. So what does that look like at this stage of the session to ensure them that they're going to see the results that they want to see?
Well, I think that just lends credence to the wisdom of not proposing very specific accountable measures without engaging the legislature in helping to formulate those accountability measures. I don't think a majority of the legislature would want to mandate some of these mandate, say, a salary level. Some states have done that. I think they're trying to get out of that because they realize it's more appropriate to have government decisions be closest to those affected by those government decisions. That's a good principle behind the wisdom of local control. At the same time, as I said earlier, I think it's important that those accountability measures be there so that decisions that are made locally are transparent to those who elect the officials who make them. And so I'm hopeful that the legislature and my administration will come to agreement on some concrete accountability measures that will reassure the legislature that these dollars will indeed find their way into teacher pay.
Do you have any idea on what those might look like?
Well, in my mind, some of the things should be publication of the target ratio that's most efficient for their school, or the target ratio upon which funding is based. So for example, if your school district has fewer than 200 students, it should be readily apparent through periodic publication that your district should have a target student-to-teacher ratio of 12.5 to 1. And if you're and here is what the actual ratio is this year. Here is what the actual ratio was last year. Here is what it was the year before. And so you can see if the district is moving toward a more efficient allocation of their resources and in a more efficient staffing pattern, or if they're not. And some small school districts are already there. They're already meeting those ratios. Some are not. Some large school districts are meeting the 15-to-1 ratio. Some are not. And so this helps the local, and maybe there's good reasons for it. Maybe there's good reasons. But if so, this juxtaposition of the target ratio and actual ratio should create good conversation and force school leaders to understand and defend and substantiate the basis for the decisions they're making about spending and staffing.
Governor, do you have an opinion or on whether or not you would support the cultivation of industrial hemp? That's a bill lawmakers are considering this session.
I don't support the cultivation of industrial hemp. I think that is an unlikely profitable venture. I think to the extent that some may do it, some states may allow it, I'd be interested to see the profitability of those who are doing it in those states. And I think it's likely it's a very niche market if there's any profitability at all, sort of like the organic market, where people buy it just because they it's not necessarily superior in quality or durability or appearance, but it is just something they want to do to support that industry. And I think that the opportunity for that niche to enable profitable growing of hemp is very slim. And I think, conversely, the opportunity for dressing up industrial or recreational hemp as an industrial effort is much more likely. So I do not support industrial hemp. I can understand the rationale and the discussion of those who say, well, it doesn't have the THC content that recreational marijuana would provide or medicinal marijuana would provide. It's used for rope or it's used for clothing, all fine and good. But there's lots of plants that are available other than industrial hemp that provide some of those same qualities, and there's no overwhelming market demand for them. So I really think this is a distraction.
Well, it looks like we're out of time. So thank you all for coming.
Yep, thank you.